Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein continued. Cassette 8, Side 2. Patricia Pywonski pointed her finger and suddenly was a priestess clothed in holy dignity and mystic symbols. God wants us to be happy. He filled the world with things to make us happy. Would God let grape juice turn to wine if he didn't want us to drink and be joyful? He could let it stay grape juice, or turn it into vinegar that nobody could get a giggle out of. Ain't that true? Of course, he don't mean we should get roaring drunk and beat your wife and neglect your kids. He gave us good things to use, not abuse. If you feel like a drink or sex among friends who have seen the light, and it makes you want to dance and give thanks to the Lord for his goodness, why not? God made alcohol and God made feet. He made them so you could put them together and be happy. She paused. Fill her up again, honey. Preaching is thirsty work. Not much ginger ale, that's good rye. And that ain't all. If God didn't want women to be looked at, he would have made them ugly. That's reasonable, isn't it? God isn't a cheat. He set up the game himself. He wouldn't rig it so that the marks can't win, like a flat joint wheel in a town with a fix on. He wouldn't send anybody to hell for losing in a crooked game. All right. God wants us to be happy, and he told us how. Love one another. Love a snake if the poor thing needs love. Love thy neighbor. And the back of your hand only to Satan's corruptors who want to lead you away from the appointed path and down into the pit. And by love, he didn't mean namby-pamby old maid love that's scared to look up from a hymn book for fear of seeing a temptation of the flesh. If God hated flesh, why did he make so much of it? God is no sissy. He made the Grand Canyon and comets coursing through the sky and cyclones and stallions and earthquakes. Can a God who can do all that turn around and practically wet his pants just because some little Sheila leans over a mite and a man catches a sight of a tit? You know better, hon, and so do I. When God told us to love, he wasn't holding out a card on us. He meant it. Love little babies that always need changing. And love strong, smelly men so that there will be more babies to love. And in between, go on loving because it's so good to love. Of course, that don't mean to peddle it any more than a bottle of rye means I gotta get fighting drunk and clobber a cop. You can't sell love and you can't buy happiness. No price tags on either. And if you think there is, the way to hell lies open. But if you give with an open heart and receive what God has an unlimited supply of, the devil can't touch you. Money? She looked at Jill. Hon, would you do that water-sharing thing with somebody? Say for $1 million. Make it $10 million, tax-free. Of course not. Michael, do you grok this?
Almost in fullness, Jill. Waiting is.
You see, dearie, I knew love was in that water. Your seeker's very near the light. But since you two, from the love that is in you, did share water and grow closer, as Michael says, I can tell you things I couldn't ordinarily tell a seeker.
The Reverend Foster, self-ordained or ordained by God, depending on authority cited, had an instinct for the pulse of his times stronger than that of a skilled carny sizing up a mark. The culture known as America had a split personality throughout its history. Its laws were puritanical. Its covert behavior tended to be Rabelaisian. Its major religions were Apollonian. Its revivals were almost Dionysian. In the 20th century, Terran Christian era, nowhere on earth was sex so vigorously suppressed, and nowhere was there such deep interest in it. Foster had in common with every great religious leader of that planet two traits. He had an extremely magnetic personality, and sexually he did not fall near the human norm. On earth, great religious leaders were always either celibate or the antithesis. Foster was not celibate. Nor were his wives and priestesses. The clincher for rebirth under the new revelation included a ritual uniquely suited for growing closer. In Terran history, many cults had used the same technique, but not on a major scale in America before Foster's time. Foster was run out of town more than once before he perfected a method that permitted him to expand his Capric cult. He borrowed from Freemasonry, Catholicism, the Communist Party, and Madison Avenue, just as he borrowed from earlier scriptures in composing his new revelation. He sugarcoated it all as a return to primitive Christianity. He set up an outer church which anybody could attend. Then there was a middle church, which to outward appearance was the church of the new revelation, the happy saved who paid tithes, enjoyed all benefits of the church's ever-widening business tie-ins, and whooped it up in an endless carnival of happiness, happiness, happiness. Their sins were forgiven, and very little was sinful, as long as they supported their church, dealt honestly with fellow Fosterites, condemned sinners, and stayed happy. The new revelation did not specifically encourage lechery, but it got quite mystical in discussing sexual conduct. The Middle Church supplied shock troops. Foster borrowed a trick from early 20th century Wobblies. If a community tried to suppress a Fosterite movement, Fosterites converged on that town until neither jails nor cops could handle them. Cops had ribs kicked in, and jails were smashed. If a prosecutor was rash enough to push an indictment, it was impossible to make it stick. Foster, after learning under fire, saw to it that prosecutions were persecution under the letter of the law. No conviction of a Fosterite qua Fosterite was ever upheld by the Supreme Court, nor later by the High Court. Inside the overt church was the inner church, a hard core of fully dedicated, who made up the priesthood, the lay leaders, all keepers of keys and makers of policy. They were reborn, beyond sin, certain of heaven, and sole celebrants of the inner mysteries. Foster selected these with great care, personally, until the operation got too big. He looked for men like himself, and for women like his priestess wives, dynamic, utterly convinced, stubborn, and free, or able to be freed, once guilt and insecurity were purged, of jealousy in its most human meaning, and all of them potential satyrs and nymphs, as the secret church was that Dionysian cult that America had lacked, and for which there was enormous potential market. He was most cautious. If candidates were married, it had to be both spouses. Unmarried candidates had to be sexually attractive and aggressive, and he impressed on his priests that males must equal or exceed in number the females. Nowhere was it recorded that Foster studied earlier similar cults in America, but he knew, or sensed, that most such had foundered because possessive concupiscence of their priests led to jealousy. Foster never made this error. Not once did he keep a woman to himself, not even those he married. Nor was he too eager in expanding his core group. The Middle Church offered plenty to slake the milder needs of the masses. If a revival produced two couples capable of heavenly marriage, Foster was content. If it produced none, he let the seeds grow and sent in a salted priest and priestess to nurture them. So far as possible, he tested candidate couples himself with a priestess. Since such a couple was already saved, insofar as the Middle Church was concerned, he ran little risk, none with the woman, and he always sized up the man before letting his priestess go ahead. Before she was saved, Patricia Piwanski was young, married, and very happy. She had one child. She looked up to and admired her much older husband. George Piwanski was a generous, affectionate man with only one weakness, but one which often left him too drunk to show his affection after a long day. Patty counted herself a lucky woman. True, George occasionally got affectionate with a female client, quite affectionate if it was early in the day, and of course tattooing required privacy, especially with ladies. Patty was tolerant. She sometimes made a date with a male client after George got to hitting the bottle more and more. But there was a lack in her life, one not filled even when a grateful client gave her a snake. Shipping out, he said, and couldn't keep it. She liked pets and had no snake phobia. She made a home for it in their show window, and George made a beautiful four-color picture to back it. Don't tread on me. This design turned out to be popular. She acquired more snakes, and they were a comfort. But she was the daughter of an Ulsterman and a girl from Cork. The armed truce between her parents had left her with no religion. She was already a seeker when Foster preached in San Pedro. She had managed to get George to go a few Sundays, but he had not seen the light. Foster brought them the light. They made their confessions together. When Foster returned 6 months later, the Piwanskis were so dedicated that he gave them personal attention. I never had a minute's trouble from the day George saw the light, she told Mike and Jill. He still drank, but only in church and never too much. When our holy leader returned, George had started his great project. Naturally, we wanted to show it to Foster. Mrs. Piwanski hesitated. Kids, I ought not to tell this. Then don't, Jill said emphatically. Patty, darling, we don't want you ever to do anything you don't feel easy about. Sharing water has to be easy. I do want to, but remember, this is church things, so you mustn't tell anyone.
just as I wouldn't tell anything about you.
Mike nodded. Here on Earth, we called it water brother business. On Mars, there's no problem. But here, I grok there sometimes is. Water brother business, you don't repeat.
I grok. That's a funny word, but I'm learning it. All right, darlings, this is water brother business. Did you know that all Fosterites are tattooed? Real church members, I mean, the ones who are eternally saved forever and a day, like me. Oh, I don't mean tattooed all over, but see that, right over my heart? That's Foster's holy kiss. George worked it in so that it looks like part of the picture, so that nobody could guess. But it's his kiss. And Foster put it there himself. She looked ecstatically proud. They examined it. It is a kiss mark, Jill said wonderingly. Like somebody had kissed you there wearing lipstick. I thought it was part of that sunset. Yes, indeedy, that's how George fixed it. Because you don't show Foster's kiss to anyone who doesn't wear Foster's kiss, and I never have, up to now. But, she insisted, you're going to wear one, both of you, someday, and when you do, I want to tattoo him on. Jill said, I don't understand, Patty. How can he kiss us? After all, he's up in heaven. Yes, dearie, he is. Let me explain. Any priest or priestess can give you Foster's kiss. It means God's in your heart. God is part of you. Forever.
Mike was suddenly intent. Thou art God.
Huh, Michael? Well, I've never heard it put that way, but that does express it. God is in you and of you and with you, and the devil can't get at you.
Yes, agreed Mike. You grok God.
He thought happily that this was nearer to putting the concept across than he had ever managed before. Except that Jill was learning it in Martian, which was inevitable. That's the idea, Michael. God groks you, and you are married in holy love and eternal happiness to his church. The priest or priestess kisses you, and the mark is tattooed on to show it's forever. It doesn't have to be this big. Mine is exactly the size and shape of Foster's blessed lips, and it can be placed anywhere to shield from sinful eyes. Any spot where it won't be noticed, then you show it when you go into a happiness gathering of the eternally saved. I've heard of happiness meetings, Jill commented, but I've never known quite what they are.
Well, Mrs. Piwanski said judicially,
there are happiness meetings and happiness meetings. The ones for ordinary members who are saved but might backslide are fun. Grand parties with only the amount of praying that comes happily, and plenty of whoop-it-up that makes a good party. Maybe a little real lovin', but you'd better be mighty careful who and how, because you mustn't be a seed of dissension among the brethren. The church is very strict about keeping things in their proper places.
But a happiness meeting for the eternally saved, well, you don't have to be careful, because there won't be anybody there who can sin, all past and done with.
If you want to drink and pass out, okay, it's God's will, or you wouldn't want to. You want to kneel down and pray, or lift up your voice in song, or tear off your clothes and dance, it's God's will. There can't possibly be anybody there who would see anything wrong in it.
It sounds like quite a party, said Jill.
Oh, it is, always. And you're filled with heavenly bliss. If you wake up in the morning with one of the eternally saved brethren, he's there because God willed it to make you all blessedly happy. They've all got Foster's kiss. They're yours.
She frowned thoughtfully.
It feels a little like sharing water. You understand?
I grok,
agreed Mike.
Mike? Wait, Jill. Wait for fullness.
But don't think, Patricia said earnestly, that a person can get into an inner temple happiness meeting just with a tattoo mark. A visiting brother or sister will take me. As soon as I know where the carny is going, I write the local churches and send my fingerprints so they can check them against the file of eternally saved at Archangel Foster Tabernacle. I give them my address, care of billboard. Then when I do, and I always go Sundays and never miss a happiness meeting, even if Tim has to slough the blow off, I am identified. They're glad to see me. I'm an added attraction with my unique and unsurpassed sacred pictures. I often spend an evening just letting people examine me. Every minute of it, bliss. Sometimes the priest has me bring honey bun to do Eve and the serpent. That takes body makeup, of course. Some brother plays Adam and we get scourged out of the Garden of Eden, and the priest explains the real meaning, not the twisted lies. And we end by regaining our blessed innocence. And that gets the party rolling. Joy!
She added,
but everybody is interested in my Foster's kiss. Because since he went back to heaven 20 years ago, not many have a Foster's kiss that wasn't laid on by proxy. I have the tabernacle testify to that, too, and I tell them about it.
Mrs. Pywonski hesitated, then told them in explicit detail. And Jill wondered where her limited ability to blush had gone. Then she grokked that Mike and Patty were two of a kind, God's innocents, unable to sin no matter what they did. She wished, for Patty's sake, that Foster had really been a holy prophet who had saved her for eternal bliss. But Foster, God's wounds, what a travesty! Suddenly, through her greatly improved recall, Jill was back in a room with a glass wall, looking into Foster's dead eyes. But he seemed alive, and she felt a shiver in her loins and wondered what she would have done if Foster had offered her his holy kiss and his holy self. She shut it out of her mind, but not before Mike caught it. She felt him smile with knowing innocence. She stood up.
Pettycake, darling, what time do you have to be at the lot?
Oh, dear, I should be back this blessed minute.
Why, the show doesn't roll until 9:30.
Well, Honeybun misses me. She's jealous if I stay out late. Can't you tell her that it's a happiness meeting?
The older woman gathered Jill in her arms.
It is. It certainly is.
Good. I'm going to sleep. Jill is bushed. What time do you have to be up?
If I'm back by 8, I can get Sam to tear down my top and have time to make sure my babies are loaded safely.
Breakfast?
I'll get it on the train. Just coffee when I wake up, usually.
I make that here. You dare stay up as long as you like. I won't let you oversleep.
If you sleep.
Mike doesn't sleep.
Not at all.
Never. He curls up and thinks a while, usually. But he doesn't sleep.
Mrs. Pywonski nodded solemnly.
Another sign. I know. And, Michael, someday you will know. Your call will come.
Maybe, agreed Jill.
Mike, I'm falling asleep. Pop me into bed, please.
She was lifted, wafted into the bedroom. Covers rolled themselves back. She slept. Jill woke at 7, slipped out of bed, put her head into the other room. Lights were out and shades were tight, but they were not asleep. Jill heard Mike say with soft certainty,
"Thou art God."
"Thou art God," Patricia whispered, in a voice as heavy as if drugged.
"Yes, Jill is God."
"Jill is God, yes, Michael."
"And thou art God."
"Thou art God. Now, Michael, now."
Jill went quietly away and brushed her teeth. Presently, she let Mike know that she was awake and found that he knew it. When she came back into the living room, sunlight was streaming in.
"Good morning, darlings."
She kissed them.
"Thou art God,"
Patty said simply.
"Yes, Patty. And thou art God. God is in all of us."
She looked at Patty in the harsh morning light and noted that she did not look tired. Well, she knew that effect. If Mike wanted her to stay up all night, Jill never found it any trouble. She suspected that her sleepiness the night before had been Mike's idea, and heard Mike agree in his mind. "Now coffee, darlings, and I happen to have stashed away a ready pack of orange juice, too." They breakfasted lightly, replete with happiness. Jill saw Patty looking thoughtful.
"What is it, dear?" "I hate to mention this, but what are you kids going to eat on? Aunt Patty has a pretty well-stuffed grouch bag, and I thought..."
Jill laughed. "Oh, darling, I shouldn't laugh. But the man from Mars is rich. Surely you know." Mrs. Pywonski looked baffled.
"Well, I guess I knew. But you can't trust anything you hear over the news.
Patty, you're an utter darling. Believe me, now that we're water brothers, we wouldn't hesitate. Sharing the nest isn't just poetry. But it's the other way around. If you ever need money, just say so. Any amount, any time. Write us. Better yet, call me. Mike doesn't have the foggiest idea about money. Why, dear, I'm keeping a couple of $100,000 in my name right now. Want some?"
Mrs. Pywonski looked startled. "Bless me, I don't need money."
Jill shrugged.
"If you ever do, just holler. If you want a yacht, Mike would enjoy giving you a yacht."
"I certainly would, Pat. I've never seen a yacht."
Mrs. Pywanski shook her head. Don't take me up on a tall mountain, dearie. All I want from you two is your love. You have that, Jill told her.
I don't grok love, Mike said. But Jill always speaks rightly. If we've got it, it's yours.
And to know that you're saved. But I'm no longer worried about that. Mike has told me about waiting and why waiting is. You understand, Jill?
I grok.
I'm no longer impatient about anything. But I have something for you, too. The tattooed lady got her purse, took a book out. My dear ones, this is the very copy of the new revelation that Blessed Foster gave me, the night he placed his kiss on me. I want you to have it.
Jill's eyes filled with tears.
But, Aunt Patty, Patty, our brother, we can't take this one. We'll buy one.
No, it's water I'm sharing with you for growing closer.
Oh,
Jill jumped up.
We'll share it. It's ours now, all of us.
She kissed her.
Mike tapped her shoulder. Greedy little brother. My turn.
I'll always be greedy that way.
The man from Mars kissed his new brother, first on her mouth, then kissed the spot Foster had kissed. He pondered, briefly by Earth time, picked a corresponding spot on the other side where George's design could be matched, kissed her there, while he thought by stretched out time and in great detail. It was necessary to grok the capillaries.
To the other two, he briefly pressed his lips to skin. But Jill caught a hint of his effort.
Patty, see.
Mrs. Pywanski looked down. Marked on her, paired stigmata in blood red, were his lips. She started to faint, then showed her staunch faith.
Yes, yes, Michael.
Shortly, the tattooed lady was replaced by a mousy housewife in high neck, long sleeves, and gloves.
I won't cry, she said soberly, and there are no goodbyes in eternity. I will be waiting.
She kissed them, left without looking back. Chapter 28.
Blasphemy!
Foster looked up. Something bite you, Junior? This annex had been run up in a hurry, and things did get in. Swarms of almost invisible imps, usually. Harmless, but a bite from one left an itch on the ego.
You'd have to see it to believe it. Here, I'll run the omniscio back a touch.
You'd be surprised at what I can believe, Junior. Nevertheless, Digby's supervisor shifted part of his attention. Three temporals. Humans, he saw they were. A man and two women, speculating about the eternal. Nothing odd about that.
Yes? You heard what she said? Archangel Michael indeed.
What about it?
What about it? Oh, for God's sake!
Very possibly. Digby's halo quivered.
Foster, you must not have taken a good look. She meant that overage juvenile delinquent that sent me to the showers. Scan it again.
Foster let the gain increase, noted that the angel in training had spoken rightly, and noticed something else, and smiled his angelic smile.
How do you know he isn't, Junior?
Huh?
I haven't seen Mike around the club lately, and his name has been scratched on the Millennial Solipsist Tournament. That's a sign that he's likely away on detached duty. Mike is one of the most eager solipsism players in this sector.
But the notion's obscene.
You'd be surprised how many of the boss's best ideas have been called obscene in some quarters. Or rather, you should not be surprised in view of your field work. But obscene is a null concept. It has no theological meaning. To the pure, all things are pure.
But
I'm still witnessing, Junior. In addition to the fact that our brother Michael seems to be away at this micro-instant, I don't keep track of him. We're not on the same watch list. That tattooed lady who made that oracular pronouncement is not likely to be mistaken. She's a very holy temporal herself.
Who says?
I say.
I know. Foster smiled again with angelic sweetness. Dear little Patricia, getting a little long in the tooth, but still earthily desirable, and shining with an inner light that made her look like a stained glass window. He noted, without temporal pride, that George had finished his great dedication since he had last looked at Patricia. That picture of his being called up to heaven wasn't bad.
Not bad at all, in the higher sense. He must remember to look up George and compliment him on it, and tell him he had seen Patricia. Where was George? A creative artist in the universe design section, working right under the architect, as he recalled. No matter. The master file would dig him out in a split millennium. What a delicious little butterball Patricia had been, and such holy frenzy! If she had had just a touch more assertiveness and a touch less humility, he could have made her a priestess. But such was Patricia's need to accept God according to her own nature that she could have qualified only among the Lingayats, where she wasn't needed. Foster considered scanning back and seeing her as she had been. Decided against it with angelic restraint. There was work to be done. Forget the omniscio, Junior. I want a word with you. Digby did so and waited. Foster twanged his halo, an annoying habit he had when he was meditating. Junior, you aren't shaping up too angelically.
I'm sorry.
Sorry is not for eternity. But the truth is, you've been preoccupied with that young fellow who may or may not be our brother Michael. Now wait. In the first place, it is not for you to judge the instrument used to call you from the pasture. In the second place, it is not he who vexes you. You hardly knew him. What's bothering you is that little brunette secretary you had. She had earned my kiss quite some temporal period before you were called, hadn't she?
I was still testing her.
Then no doubt you have been angelically pleased to note that Supreme Bishop Short, after giving her a thorough examination himself, oh, most thorough, I told you he would measure up, has passed her, and she now enjoys the wider happiness she deserves. A shepherd should take joy in his work, but when he's promoted, he should joy in that, too. Now it happens there is a spot open for a guardian in training in a new sector being opened up. A job under your nominal rank, I concede, but good angelic experience. This planet, well, you think of it as a planet, you'll see, is occupied by a race of tripolarity instead of bipolarity, and I have it on high authority that Don Juan himself could not manage to take earthly interest in any of their three polarities. That's not opinion. He was borrowed as a test. He screamed and prayed to be returned to the solitary hell he has created for himself.
Going to send me to Flatbush, huh? So I won't interfere.
Tut, tut, you can't interfere. The one impossibility that permits all else to be possible. I tried to tell you that when you arrived. But don't let it fret you. You are eternally permitted to try. Your orders will include a loop so that you will check back here now without loss of temporality. Now fly away and get cracking. I have work to do. Foster turned back to where he had been interrupted. Oh, yes, a poor soul temporarily designated as Alice Douglas. To be a goad was a hard assignment, and she had met it unflaggingly. But her job was complete, and now she would need rest and rehabilitation from the inescapable battle fatigue. She'd be kicking and screaming and foaming ectoplasm at all orifices. Oh, she would need exorcism after a job that rough. But they were all rough. They couldn't be anything else. And Alice Douglas was an utterly reliable field operative. She could take any left-hand assignment, as long as it was essentially virginal. Burn her at the stake or put her in a nunnery, she always delivered. Not that he cared much for virgins, other than with professional respect for any job well done. Foster sneaked a last look at Mrs. Pywanski. There was a fellow worker he could appreciate. Darling little Patricia, what a blessed, lusty benison. Chapter 29. As the door closed behind Patricia, Jill said,
"What now, Mike?"
"We're leaving." "Jill, you've read some abnormal psychology."
"Yes, not as much as you have."
"You know the symbolism of tattooing? And snakes?"
"Of course, I knew that about Patty as soon as I met her. I had been hoping that you would find a way."
"I couldn't until we were water brothers. Sex is a helpful goodness, but only if it is sharing and growing closer. I grok that if I did it without growing closer..." "Well, I'm not sure."
"I grok you couldn't, Mike. That is one reason, one of the many reasons, I love you."
"I still don't grok love."
"Jill, I don't grok people."
"But I didn't want Pat to leave."
"Stop her. Keep her with us."
"Waiting is, Jill. I know."
He added,
"I doubt if we could give her all she needs. She wants to give herself all the time, to everybody. Happiness meetings and snakes and marks aren't enough for Pat.
She wants to offer herself on an altar to everybody in the world, always, and make them happy. This new revelation, I grok it as other things to other people, but that is what it is to Pat.
Yes, Mike. Dear Mike.
Time to leave. Pick a dress and get your purse. I'll dispose of the trash. Jill thought wistfully that she would like to take one or two things. Mike always moved on with just the clothes on his back, and seemed to grok that she preferred it that way.
I'll wear that pretty blue one.
It floated out, posed over her, wriggled on to her as she held up her hands. The zipper closed. Shoes walked toward her. She stepped into them.
I'm ready.
Mike had caught the flavor of her thought, but not the concept. It was too alien to Martian ideas.
Jill, do you want to stop and get married?
She thought about it.
It's Sunday. We couldn't get a license.
Tomorrow, then. I grok you would like it.
No, Mike.
Why not, Jill?
We wouldn't be any closer. We already share water. That's true both in English and Martian.
Yes.
And a reason just in English. I wouldn't have Dorcas and Anne and Miriam and Patty think that I was trying to crowd them out.
Jill, none of them would think so.
I won't chance it because I don't need it. Because you married me in a hospital room ages and ages ago.
She hesitated.
But there is something you might do for me.
What, Jill?
Well, you might call me pet names, the way I do you.
Yes, Jill. What pet names?
Oh. She kissed him quickly. Mike, you're the sweetest, most lovable man I've ever met, and the most infuriating creature on two planets. Don't bother. Just call me little brother occasionally. It makes me all quivery inside.
Yes, little brother.
Oh, my. Let's get out of here before I take you back to bed. Meet me downstairs. I'll be paying the bill.
She left suddenly. They caught the first greyhound going anywhere. A week later, they stopped at home, shared water for a few days, left without saying goodbye. Goodbye was one human custom Mike resisted. He used it only with strangers. Shortly, they were in Las Vegas, stopping in a hotel off the strip. Mike tried the games while Jill killed time as a showgirl. She couldn't sing or dance. Parading in a tall, improbable hat, a smile and a scrap of tinsel was the job suited to her in the Babylon of the West. She preferred to work if Mike was busy. And somehow, Mike always got her the job she picked. Since casinos never closed, Mike was busy almost all the time. Mike was careful not to win much, keeping to limits Jill set. After he had milked each casino for a few thousand, he put it all back, never letting himself be the big money player. Then he took a job as a croupier, letting the little ball roll without interference, and studying people, trying to grok why they gambled. He grokked a drive that felt intensely sexual, but he seemed to grok wrongness in this. Jill assumed that the customers in the palatial theater restaurant where she worked were just marks, and as such did not count. But to her surprise, she actively enjoyed displaying herself in front of them. With increasing Martian honesty, she examined this feeling. She had always enjoyed being looked at with admiration by men whom she found attractive enough to want to touch. She had been irked that the sight of her body meant nothing to Mike, even though he was as devoted to her body as a woman could dream of. If he wasn't preoccupied. But he was generous even then. He would let her call him out of a trance, shift gears without complaint, and be smiling and eager and loving. Nevertheless, there it was. One of his strangenesses, like his inability to laugh. Jill decided, after her initiation as a showgirl, that she enjoyed being visually admired by strangers, because this was the one thing Mike did not give her. Her perfecting self-honesty soon washed out that theory. The men in the audience were mostly too old, too fat, too bald for Jill to find them attractive. And Jill had always been scornful of lecherous old wolves, although not of old men, she reminded herself. Jubal could look at her, even use crude language, and not give her any feeling that he wanted to get her alone and grope her. But now she found that these lecherous old wolves did not set her teeth on edge. When she felt their admiring stares or outright lust, and she did feel it, could identify the sources, she did not resent it. It warmed her and made her smugly pleased. Exhibitionism had been to her just a technical term, a weakness she held in contempt. Now, in digging out her own and looking at it,
She decided that either this form of narcissism was normal, or she was abnormal. But she didn't feel abnormal. She felt healthier than ever. She had always been of rugged health. Nurses need to be. But she hadn't had a sniffle or an upset stomach in... she couldn't remember when. Why, not even cramps. Okay, if a healthy woman liked to be looked at, then it follows, as the night the day, that healthy men should like to look. Else there was just no darn sense to it. At which point, she finally understood, intellectually, Duke and his pictures. She discussed it with Mike, but Mike could not understand why Jill had ever minded being looked at. He understood not wishing to be touched. Mike avoided shaking hands. He wanted to be touched only by Water Brothers. Jill wasn't sure how far this went. She had explained homosexuality after Mike had read about it and failed to grok, and had given him rules for avoiding passes. She knew that Mike, pretty as he was, would attract such. He had followed her advice and had made his face more masculine, instead of the androgynous beauty he had had. But Jill was not sure that Mike would refuse a pass, say, from Duke. Fortunately, Mike's male Water Brothers were decidedly masculine, just as his others were very female women. Jill suspected that Mike would grok a wrongness in the poor in-betweeners anyhow. They would never be offered water. Nor could Mike understand why it now pleased her to be stared at. The only time their attitudes had been roughly similar had been as they left the carnival, when Jill had become indifferent to stares. She saw now that her present self-knowledge had been nascent then. She had not been truly indifferent to masculine stares. Under the stresses of adjusting to the man from Mars, she had shucked off part of her cultural conditioning, that degree of prissiness a nurse can retain despite a no-nonsense profession. But Jill hadn't known that she had any prissiness until she lost it. At last, she was able to admit to herself that there was something inside her as happily shameless as a tabby in heat. She tried to explain this to Mike, giving her theory of the complementary functions of narcissist display and voyeurism. "The truth is, Mike, I get a kick out of having men stare at me. Lots of men, and almost any man. So now I grok why Duke likes pictures of women. The sexier, the better. It doesn't mean that I want to go to bed with them, any more than Duke wants to go to bed with a photograph. But when they look at me and tell me, think at me, that I'm desirable, it gives me a warm tingle right in my middle." She frowned slightly. "I ought to get a real naughty picture taken of me and send it to Duke, to tell him I'm sorry I failed to grok what I thought was a weakness in him. If it's a weakness, I've got it too, girl style. If it is a weakness, I grok it isn't."
"All right, we'll find a photographer."
She shook her head. "I'll apologize instead. I won't send such a picture. Duke has never made a pass at me, and I don't want him getting ideas."
"Jill, you would not want Duke?"
She heard an echo of Water Brother in his mind. "I've never thought about it. I guess I've been being faithful to you. But I grok you speak rightly. I wouldn't turn Duke down. And I would enjoy it, too. What do you think of that, darling?"
"I grok a goodness," Mike said seriously.
"My gallant Martian, there are times when human females appreciate a semblance of jealousy. But I don't think there is any chance that you will ever grok jealousy. Darling, what would you grok if one of those marks made a pass at me?"
Mike barely smiled. "I grok he would be missing."
"I grok he might. But Mike, listen, dear, you promised you wouldn't do anything of that sort except in utter emergency. If you hear me scream and reach into my mind and I'm in real trouble, that's another matter. But I was coping with wolves when you were still on Mars. 9 times out of 10, if a girl gets raped, it's partly her fault, so don't be hasty."
"I will remember. I wish you were sending that naughty picture to Duke."
"What, dear?" "If I make a pass at Duke, and I may, now that you put the idea in my head, I'd rather grab his shoulders and say, 'Duke, how about it? I'm willing. I don't want to do it by sending him a picture, like those nasty women used to send to you. But if you want me to, okay.'"
Mike frowned. "If you wish to send Duke a naughty picture, do so. If you not wish, then not. But I had hoped to see the naughty picture taken." "Jill, what is a naughty picture?"
Mike was baffled by Jill's reversal in attitude, plus long-standing bafflement at Duke's art collection. But the pale Martian thing which parallels tumultuous human sexuality gave him no foundation for grokking either narcissism or voyeurism, modesty or display. He added, "Naughty means a small wrongness, but I grok you did not mean a wrongness, but a goodness."
A naughty picture could be either, I guess, depending on who it's for, now that I'm over my prejudice. But, Mike, I'll have to show you. I can't tell you. Close those slats, will you?
Venetian blinds flipped themselves shut.
All right, she said. This pose is just a little naughty. Any showgirl would use it as a professional pick. And this is a bit more so. Some girls would use it. But this is unmistakably naughty. And this one is quite naughty. And this is so extremely naughty that I wouldn't pose with my face wrapped in a towel, unless you wanted it.
If your face was covered, why would I want it?
Ask Duke. That's all I can say.
I grok not wrongness. I grok not goodness. I grok...
He used a Martian word, indicating a null state of all emotions. Because he was baffled, they went on discussing it, in Martian when possible, because of its extremely fine discriminations for emotions and values, and in English because Martian couldn't cope with the concepts. To pursue this mystery, Mike took a ringside table that night, Jill having coached him in how to bribe the maître d'hôtel. Jill came strutting out in the first number, her smile for everyone, but a wink for Mike. She discovered that with Mike present, the warm, pleased sensation she had been enjoying nightly was greatly amplified. She suspected that she would glow in the dark. When the girls formed a tableau, Mike was about 10 feet from Jill. She had been promoted to a front position. The director had shifted her on the fourth day, saying, "I don't know what it is, kid. We've got girls with twice your build, but you've got what customers look at." She posed and talked with Mike in her mind.
"Feel anything?"
"I grok, but not in fullness.